The Dalai Lama, I'm sorry, Dr. Dhanden, I was talking to him about the practice of medicine in the mountains in Tibet, in the hills, because Tibetan is a very hilly area. He told me how he made these different movements and got all kinds of information from pulses and stuff. And then he talked about the herbs that are used on the mountainside. He said that they harvest herbs in the light and the dark, and in the shady side and the sunny side, and also when it's in the root and when it's in the leaf. It's like sassafras. For any of you who know the South, they used to get sassafras roots to make sassafras tea. And I realized when he talked about that and how they prescribe their medicines, herbs, I realized that there's a fundamental difference between land-based, sea level-based medicine and high-level mountain-based medicine. That if we go to Machu Picchu or to extreme places with extreme heights, we need to think in a slightly different medical model. So when I started thinking about this in the most broad context, I always look for the big picture. I realized that Tibetan medicine, just like traditional Chinese medicine, involves not only a condition, not only some educated response to that condition, but now we have the problem of translating from one system to the next. And in the context of your question, what I see to be both exciting as well as challenging is the problem of translation. Because it's not just like translating from French to English or German to French or German to English, where we just make a set of changes in words and we have the simple concepts. We fundamentally are asking for a translation between conceptualization of bits of self in some way. So as we talk about the various approaches to religious experience and spiritual experiences and meaningfulness and trainment and other kinds of things, we really have to find ways of making that real in the other system. We have people, for example, who go from the West to the East to gain some particular benefit from the way the system works in the East. And we have some people coming to the West to gain some benefit. But it is always a kind of tapping into it, not holistically becoming a part of it. And I see that as being another part of the big picture that we really need to deal with. And that's why I gave the example of South Africa, because that's more Western in some ways, but it still says that there's a long way to go in making that transition. Right.
One more question, if you might. Just because you're really into the physics of this system, very heavily into the physics of consciousness and how we might actually fix it. So I think your work can parallel that rather strongly. But I did have one question, which you might have the answer for. There's been a number of cases where people have transplanted organs, and they suddenly acquire the memories of the person that they got the transplant from. So maybe you have any thoughts about that and how that works, because it's like long-term LTM, long-term memory, which has been embedded in the cell structure of these other organs. And has that sort of, or have you looked at this at all?
I thought about it. I don't have an answer yet because I'm concentrating on making the first step. I should say, because you asked the question before we started the talk about, some of you have been to some of the talks I presented in the past, and in one of the talks I talked about my molecular computer, where if my notion of DNA change is correct, then we have to find a way to explain how information is going into the system as well as coming out of the system. And that's in fact how that device was first conceptualized. And in fact, Francis Crick has given us the notion of the central dogma, information going from DNA to RNA to proteins. And I said back in 1981, 82, 83, that there has to be a corresponding pathway going the other direction. I call it an inverse information pathway. And I said that nature and God are never, I stupidly said, but what I really meant it, God is not so stupid to do things in the same, in the opposite direction, in the exact opposite way. That there has to be something informative of this inverse pathway. The best way to see it is we look at the electron flow in animals and the electron flow in plants, and we see that there's a parallelism, but there's not an identity. Likewise, in the case of the flow of information in my molecular computer, the flow of information is from conformational, from shape of molecule to something I call transduction, to something that causes changes in DNA. And that's why I focused on the slow viruses, because the slow viruses, almost all of them result in changes to DNA, either as a provirus, as in the case of a retrovirus, or the prions change the shape of the or the molecular dynamics, the flow pattern on the surface and within the cell. Now, come to your point about this memory. I can conceive of it working where it does get passed along. I can conceive of it getting passed a certain, because I see parsimony is the word I use, between immune memory and memory in brain. But I don't see that same parsimony extending to the germline and to the germline so that it would be directly passed on. I never would rule out the possibility, though. What I am fascinated by is that if we think about the way birds and other animals respond to technology, like we have power lines now overhead, and birds adapt to that. That's a form of nurturance in some way. And those changes are going to be reflected somewhere, in not just in brain, but in other aspects. And I just don't know how far it's going to go. Now, in terms of organ transplants, maybe that's the technology that we need to help us get some better appreciation for how that works.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting anecdotal, just like a window or a snapshot in front of the concept that there is a transceiving of information, sort of like a holographic transceiving of information, at the cellular level, at the proteomic level. So it's not just confined to the physical era here, but in fact, transit is sort of like proteomic platform, if you might call it that, that occurs in all living things, actually, and that this is like a very small, like a glimpse of that process, perhaps, so almost stumbled across as an artifact of, you know, organ transplant, but gee whiz, guess what, it came along with it. So I just thought that might enter your thoughts or expand your model a little bit.
Do you have a question?
I wonder if you had any thoughts on why South Africa was so resistant to take on the AIDS problem and acknowledge it and go ahead with
it. Yes. The answer to that is, to me, it's very clear. If you know anything about AIDS, the thing that is so interesting is that the manifestations of AIDS are different in different countries. So Thabo Mbeki observed that people in South Africa were getting TB and several other diseases as the principal opportunistic infection in South Africa, and yet in the United States, the opportunistic infection was pneumocystis for a long time, TB now, but it wasn't. What he said then was, well, what's the evidence that, first of all, that HIV is the cause? And to some extent, he bought into Peter Duisberg's view on HIV may not be the cause. But he said, let's have this special commission that sits down and weighs and gives me the best advice. And he's a kind of contrarian person at some level. And because of the nature of the AIDS enterprise, everyone jumped on him. They said that you don't know what you're talking about, you're wrong. And if there's anything about the way, this negativism works, when you're told that you're wrong, you just begin to fight it and you develop all kinds of responses to that. There was finally, in fact, I wrote about it in a paper last January, There was finally a declaration, it's called the Durban Declaration, where 5,011 people, I think was the original number of signers, said that Thabo Mbeki was wrong, HIV was the sole cause of AIDS, and such and such and such a thing. I went through the list of people, and not one to the letter had ever written a paper on any of the concepts of slow viruses. No one had ever written a paper on lentiviruses as contrasted to other retroviruses. And since I had been the only person in the world, in fact, I was the first person to point out that HIV had to be a lentivirus, I said, let's stop and let's look at this thing and let's take a hard look at what really are the lessons. And I pointed out that, and again, this is not something that is widely known, but the solution to the problem, which I published in 1983 and in 87 and 94 and again in other opportunities, I said the solution is to create vaccines against the opportunistic pathogens. People with AIDS don't get common infections. They get uncommon infections. In fact, there's an old adage in medicine, when you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras. Well, in the case of AIDS, it's always the zebras. So I said, what we really need to do is to go around the world and make a list of what's common versus uncommon, what's common versus uncommon in the United States and South Africa and Japan and Bangladesh and India and Thailand and so forth. And you'll begin to see that the things that are common, except for TB, people are not getting these infections. Now, the problem is that Mbeki and others just never listened to that because of what I call the scientific divide. So we've got a schism there where he's resisting on the one hand, the medical community is resisting on the other hand. You have all these pompous persons, Cameron, the judge, saying, this is the only way to approach this problem, and it's just a kind of a standoff. And it's an unhealthy standoff because people are dying. South Africa has 25% of the population, its population now, with HIV infected. Now that brings to another issue. When I was in South Africa, I was struck by how clean it was. I've traveled all over the world, and I had never seen a society so clean as Durban was. So the question I asked was this cleaned up just for the conference? Because after all, that was a possibility. Or was this the natural way of doing things? I've talked to now many people who've gone back and forth to South Africa, and it typically, I find that that it is a clean society. But I also find that what is clean in the cities was not clean in the Soweto and some of the homeland regions and whatnot. So there's a kind of an interesting story that's not being told. This is even more complicated. It's more complicated because for years and years, I've been to 11 or 13 AIDS conferences. South Africa never had an extreme population until after Mandela became the president. So the question becomes, did all of a sudden we get a number of AIDS cases because of something about Mandela, or was it possible that the AIDS cases were being suppressed under the apartheid government, or could it be that, which is, looks like it's most likely the case, that there were in fact a large number of cases there, but the South African government just unwittingly ignored it? And to further complicate the matter is that when Mandela became president, people started coming across the border from Zaire and from Zimbabwe and some of the other places that brought even more cases of AIDS into the country. So it's a multifactorial problem, it's a serious problem, including a problem with some entrenched views between Thabo Mbeki on the one hand and the Medical Research Council on the other hand, and no one is winning. No one is winning. And the same problem has been played out in this country, too. I call it scientific apartheid. what I mean by that is that you have a group of people who pretend to know a great deal about this disease. After all, it's been around now since 1981. And yet they sit on one side of the fence and they sort of armchair it, talking about, well, if we only gave this amount of drugs and stuff to these other countries, we're going to get this problem solved. Or, oh, if we created a vaccine against HIV, we would see this solution, never recognizing that they are part of the problem in the sense that they really don't know the literature on slow viruses. This disease was solved in 1954, but few people knew it because the fellow who wrote on this, his name is Bjorn Sigurdsson, he wrote about slow viruses. He did not see that when he wrote his three papers, the classic papers, that he was describing an underlying AIDS-like disease. So it was I'm the person who brought it into the, who made the connection. But people don't read my papers either. The scientific divide that I'm describing is such that you have on the one side a group of persons who are medically trained, who pretend that their knowledge is the only knowledge. And that's the nature of medicine fundamentally. Medicine would never tell you we don't know something, because if they effectively admit that they don't know something, then they are going to have to say to their clients, their patients, why should you believe us? They don't have the equivalent of what we have in law, where you are able to go out in theory and develop a theory. So you don't find a medical doctor going to the medical library and looking for all possible reasons, thinking things through, whereas you find an attorney going to the law library and coming up with a theory and then another theory. They present the different theoretical results. In medicine, it's quite the opposite. It does not allow for that. So that's a part of the medical divide, is a professional divide. Second, in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that the people who have sort of pushed us to the brink are the persons who have HIV, the buyers clubs, the Project Inform, some of the groups like in San Francisco, ACT UP too, and different groups around the world.
Why is it that doctors are not free to do research and form a theory? You mean case by case?
I don't mean that they're not free to do things. The problem is that they're not trained to. Their minds are not trained to be free. The reason I wanted to teach medicine in the elementary and secondary schools is because I wanted to teach young kids to think about, well, what happens if you get pain in your chest? Well, of course, if it's the left part of your chest, it's probably the heart. But, I would say, what's the possibility of having a heart on the right side of your chest? Well, how many doctors would even stop and think about a heart on the right side? It turns out there is a condition, it's called situs inversus, but you would never think about it. It would be the last thing that you would think about. They're just not trained to think that way.
Say more about why demented the medical mind is inhibited from working freely.
Well, there was a Flexner report back in the early 1900s, and basically what they tried to do was to make, remember, surgery started out in the barbershops. Medical doctors would go from house, they would do house calls and whatnot. Teachers did the same thing. But medicine wanted to legitimize itself. So here you have a baccalaureate degree in medicine. These are undergraduate classes. In almost every country, you have a bachelor's degree in surgery, a bachelor's degree in medicine, a bachelor's degree in this, that, or the other. We call them doctor because that makes them legitimate somehow. The boards and state governing groups politically lobbied for the profession to have boards of quality medical assurance, is what it's called here in California, and they don't really want to see practice that is at variant between one person and another. And think about it, it's logical. You would not want to go to one doctor and he says that you have a toothache and another doctor that says you have a pain in the foot and in fact it's somewhere in your chest. However it might have happened. So you want uniformity in practice. Now, the model I like to give is food. If you go to Italy, go to any region in Italy, and you ask for steak, one region you might get steak smothered in tomatoes, one region you might get steak chopped, another region you might get a steak in a different way. One region, you'll call it rare, it'll be either red. Another region, rare means well done. If you don't allow your mind to allow for those range of possibilities, you're just not going to feel very comfortable with the world. So we are trained in this society, if that's for a rare steak, it means red to a certain extent, or pink or whatever, but there would be a fairly uniform presentation because we don't want great variance. You don't want to spend lots of money where there becomes an argument. It is professionally contraindicated is what I would say. So I don't want you to walk away thinking that I'm speaking ill against the profession. I'm simply saying you've got to recognize professionally not to their advantage to allow for osteopathy and chiropractic and all these different traditional forms of medicine because it would erode the credibility in the profession.
So that's why I don't know about the Starbucks or any other large chain.
I hadn't thought of it in that way, but...
No. I think there is a Foundation for Mind Being Research down in O'Connor Hospital in Canada. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They meet actually, I think, at O'Connor Hospital in
Canada.
And Dr. Silver Pagetta, who's now the head of it, is a medical doctor, traditionally trained. But there's a Foundation for Alternative Medicine there, too. And they are allowing for the acupuncture and the chiropractic. I mean, within O'Connor Hospital, within this traditional medical, there's, of course, tension always between the two. But I think that more and more people start seeing that.
Part of this came out of, I think it was in the Clinton administration, that they allowed for alternative medicine, a subsection in the NIH, and Effie Chow and several other people from this area were served on that board. It is opening it up. How far it's going to go, I think a lot of people perceive that it's just sort of just let them come up a certain amount, but hold them back, and let's continue the practice in the way that it's going. But Stanford also has an alternative approach like this, and you see more and more of it with, in many instances, lots of good coming out of it. For example, Spiegel at Stanford and his studies of women with breast cancer and whatnot is opening the field quite a lot, just allowing people to talk about things and to deal with hospice kinds of care and other approaches. So we see real openings, but achieves the level that I'd like to see it achieve.
Back to the Becky, wasn't his statement saying that wasn't there either another cause of AIDS or another form of transmission spreading so quickly?
And Becky was
HIV or the virus didn't cause AIDS. He was wondering if there wasn't another source.
He was asking the question, what's the evidence for any of these possibilities? So he wanted to bring together the best minds on all sides, and so he invited Duisberg, he invited the Perth group from Australia, a number of groups, and that alone created some of the division because the mainstream physicians said, we don't, these people have no credibility, and the point of my Durban Declaration paper was to say, look, none of you have, neither Peter Duisberg or the retroviralologist. He got his membership in the Academy of Sciences for his work. He has never, ever published a paper on antiviruses. And there are three categories of retroviruses. Viruses, antiviruses, and the oncoviruses. All of his work were on oncoviruses. All of the work of all these other people were oncoviruses. The Australia group talked about what they could identify, but in fact they had never done any of these things. But and Becky said, well, it's why don't we bring the best minds together and let's flesh it out. And he never did, to my knowledge, take a stance. Now, the only area where he's done something controversial is he said, well, we can't afford to pay for some of these drugs. And that was a legitimate concern. At some point, but when the Indian government, not Indian government, but the firm, forget its name right now, challenged the medical, the pharmaceutical industry and said, look, we will treat AIDS persons for $100 a year for all the medicines they need. And that forced the pharmaceutical firms to back off and make these drugs available. What Mbeki did, which I find unacceptable, if I could say so, is that he still held to his view, well, we can't afford it, but in fact he could afford it. Now, part of the politics of that is you need to understand that there was a certain subgroup of gay males, mostly white in South Africa, who really wanted the drugs brought in. They would raise the issue of we need this for women and children, but in fact what they really were lobbying for was to have these drugs brought in so that they could get them for themselves. So there was that subtle political component that was also not being dealt with. Because the press is controlled by, I can't say controlled, the press is being led to believe what everyone believes is that this is a disease that only the doctors, not only the medical community, understands how to treat it. You don't see the press giving me hundreds of pages of publicity for what I've had to say. In fact, I've had to fight just to get any recognition, and I'm really careful about popping off on any issues because I recognize that this is an extremely valuable currency, and so when I make a pronouncement, I'm very careful to be very narrowly focused and to stick to a point, whereas in response to your point, the medical community, the ACT UP group, there's a his name is Taki in South Africa. They have had some real connections with the press, and they've got this Judge Cameron who's gay, he's a member of the Supreme Court, who's a very eloquent speaker, Oxford educated, and you know, the press will publish anything he says, but you have to recognize he has a special interest, and it would be very difficult for someone to say, "Hey, back off! That you are speaking from your own personal perspective, which needs to be reflected. You know, needs to be weighed in some careful way." You're making an interesting point. Clinton's womanizing, which people make a big point about, we could have predicted. Now, some would say, is it okay to allow a president who's going to womanize or who's going to be a teetotaler, who's going to be this or that or the other? And I would hope that we would be able to at least talk about these things and talk about the implications before people would be elected. The problem is that there's going to be a lot of money, vested interest in squelching this kind of information. I mean, just look at remember when there were the first accusations about Clinton's womanizing behavior, and Hillary Clinton said, well, I'm no, was it Patsy Cline? I don't remember the Stand by your man. Yeah, that's the kind of that's what money is going to buy is quick response. That's why I was trying to remember the name of the guy who had the had the vice presidential candidate who was pulled out of the race.
Oh, you know, I gave you the, I think, wasn't it Eagleton and replaced by, I think I had it wrong.
Yeah, Ted Eagleton.
Do you see any connection in that, from what I read, it's true that Reagan in his younger years had almost a photographic memory, and he could recite back what he had read, you know, for pages, and then in his older years, he developed Alzheimer's. Is there any connection you think?
I understand the question. I don't know the answer to that, and it is a good question. I had photographic memory as a child. I don't know if I got Alzheimer's yet. What I remember is called eidetic memory, and what happens is that it fades over time. And what I've pondered is whether you just sort of wear out the amount of information you store, because there is some stuff. There are studies that would support that. There's a group at Cold Spring Harbor headed by Tom, what's his last name, where they're looking at memory in the fruit fly, and they knock out a gene and they show that the fly memorizes everything and then it can't memorize anything. So it is conceivable that you can reach a point where you don't memorize things because you've exceeded some capacity. But I don't think that would be connected with Alzheimer's per se. I think Alzheimer's is either, there's some evidence that it is genetic, the genetic components of it, but I think that the greater likelihood is that a lifestyle may play a role, for example, to Reagan did get lots of exercise, there's no question about that. But the way the blood circulates, because you tend to have people who have loss of memory for it's called presenile dementia, due to aging, due to circulation, minor strokes, microstrokes, things of that sort. We don't really know enough about Alzheimer's at this point to make that connection. But believe me, that will be, I'll keep in the back of my mind as I think about it, not just because of Reagan, not just because of myself, but because it's an interesting question that we need to really think about.
I have an interesting experiment. It's akin to mine from what you were proposing about DNA. And I'm wondering if anyone's ever done anything like this. For example, classic Pavlovian training of dogs, or let's say rats, that you train them to run a certain way in a maze, and they get their food versus they go the other way, and they do something and they don't get the food. Let's say that the rats, you have a bunch of pregnant mother rats that have received this training and have adapted to it, and they run like to the left and they get the food versus to the right and they don't get the food. Has anybody ever tried the same, tried to see if the children of these rats learn to run to the left versus the right, as an example, faster, or pick that up, or just end up doing it on themselves, without having ever seen the mother do it, except that they were in the womb and that was happening?
It's a really good question, and the closest thing that I know of that came, the studies that came closest to this were studies done back in the late 50s, early 60s. They were called the Worm Runner's Digest studies. What they did is they looked at planaria. They had the planaria going up and down a slime trough, and those who turned right, they stripped out the nervous tissue and inoculated an untrained planaria and showed that they turned right with a high probability. Those studies are classic. And then a fellow named Melvin Calvin, the Calvin cycle, Curry-Cory cycle, and Ed Bennett, who worked with him, claimed that they could not replicate the studies, and that's what led to the end of those studies that were called transfer and learning. I actually went back in the early 1980s and reviewed those studies, and I found that Calvin's lab within it had done the studies in one way where they use 20 degrees centigrade to extract the phenol extraction procedure compared to McConnell's group at Michigan using 4 degrees centigrade. So the nucleic acid material was denatured, and that could explain the results. But the point is that that line of research was washed up because of that.
To
my knowledge, no. And it's important to understand these kind of historic facts and historical facts in order to put it in context. I got interested in it for another reason. Some of you may know I worked with Sam Fusner here on Scrapie back in the 70s when I was putting forth my hypothesis, which he's now called prions and stuff. But I said, why not put these rats in these Assyrian golden hamsters, why not inoculate them with the Scrapie agent and then run them through specific kinds of activities and ask the question, could brain activity, you know, how we're using the brain, activate or further exacerbate how the Scrapie agent would be playing itself out. I couldn't get anyone to do those studies. In fact, I wrote a letter to, it was on a listserv, to a group called BSE Listserv, looking at mad cow disease, because the question comes up, what about the kids, the people who've gotten this variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease? They've eaten contaminated animals with mad cow disease. Why are they so young? And my hypothesis was maybe if they're young because their minds are so because of the nascency, the newness, the naivete of their minds that they have much greater space, you know, opportunity to become pathogenic. So if a kid is eating hamburgers, you know, in their young life, that may make a difference. But again, no one was willing to buy that. Now, a further implication of your question is why do I want to spend my time looking at human postmortem material as opposed to rats or hamsters where I can possibly train them? I've actually given a lot of thought to that. The problem is that we know a lot about human learning and what structures are involved and whatnot. We know very little about learning in other animals. We know something, don't get me wrong, but this study allows us to really focus, because we don't know anything about intellect in animals for the most part. We don't know about cerebellum function. We don't know much about the amygdala in other animals. So I said to myself, if we're going to have to sequence the DNA, it's going to be the same amount of DNA in a rat as there is in a human. We don't know anything about the numbers of genes because the Human Genome Project focused on the human genome. So why waste my time on any other animal form? And that's why, in the end, I made the decision to go this route.
Do you think that we have cleared our way of feeding cows, that we are no longer doing that in the United States through the recycling of...
There's an ongoing debate about whether we are at risk. There's a paper that came out within the last 3-4 weeks effectively arguing that we really don't have enough data about what's going on in this country. And I remind you that it's called chronic wasting disease in elk and some deer in Colorado and Wyoming. So we've got a disease that we have to worry about, and there's some evidence that that's associated with Creutzfeldt-Jakob in humans. So the possibility of a transfer to other animals, including cattle, is not to be overlooked. And in fact, part of the speculation is that those animals would not have gotten Colorado State University had a veterinary medicine program where they were playing around with scraping sheep, and the speculation that that's transferred over into the elk and deer. But again, we don't know that with certainty. It might be useful. The problem with it is that he is from such a different culture that the language would be different. But we know that he is a refined person. We know that he's a very thoughtful person. In fact, that's part of what was interesting about the tape I was looking at when I came in. They talked about how low-key he is and methodical and fanatic and whatnot. So it would be useful to see it, but I don't think it's going to give us any great insight. It certainly would allow us to see the changes in DNA, because I'm speculating the different regions. Whether it would tell us something about our culture versus his culture, us versus them, I don't think it would. But that is something that I do think about, and I wonder. As to whether I would want to take a part of his brain, I don't know that I want to take on the politics of that. From a scientific perspective, any brains that I can get.
Yeah. It's very interesting that it seems to me that part of what you're proposing is a hypothesis that, to put it in a nutshell, is that nurture over a couple of generations or so can actually change nature in subtle ways.
Oh, there's no question about it. And the question is, how is that how much can it change it, and how is that being changed? But you know, let's suppose that you've been exposed to the bombs that had dropped on either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I have no doubt that not only would your fear factors and other factors come into play, but because of those things, you might find that you would stay out of certain environments and complexion would change. There would be subtle influences, and that will be something that it will be worth taking a look at. In fact, there was a meeting in Anaheim last week on comparative biological systems, and they were talking about evo-devo, evolution and development, and eco-devo, ecological change and development. And I have the eco-devo stuff is only now coming into some favor, but I have little doubt that ecological contributions to nurturance will, in fact, have a bearing on development.
What has me really concerned is when I think about the Middle East, specifically the Israelis and the Palestinians over generations, what's happening, or you look at something long ingrained like Northern Ireland over generations of people at war with each other. Prejudice is built up, and the possibility that there are genetic components built into the people.
Yes.
Is this a real factor that we may be facing in millions of people?
I'm sure that it's a problem. In fact, I thought a lot about this. I was in Jerusalem when I presented this first paper in 1979, and I was struck by how people were really dishonest about what was at issue. The issue there is land, money, and water. It has nothing to do with religion for the most part. There's a power grab to get as much land as possible. That's what the settlement policy is all about. Whether we like it or not, but that's what it is. And what really frightens me, to take the example you just gave, what really frightens me is that Charo's stance at the Temple Mount has so traumatized people that I have no doubt, and in fact, a good example of that is Christians in Bethlehem and other Nablus and some other sites are leaving because they don't want to be over there because of the paranoia that that people are developing. And there's going to be a tit for tat policy until either Sharon is knocked off. I mean, that's a fair prediction that we can make. Not saying it's right or wrong, but if this is going to go on until we just have no end of the bloodshed, and it's a really sad situation, and I have no doubt that it's going to traumatize these people for life. All you have to do is look at the people, Jewish people who lived through the Holocaust and how they propagate this rage and this anger about the Holocaust, as contrasted to the Armenians that went through the Turkish pogroms. And there are many more Armenians lost their lives than Jews that lost their lives in the Holocaust. But the way this thing gets continually propagated, it really is going to have a profound effect. And we're going to see that in Northern Ireland versus the Irish Republic. We're going to see it in Bosnia and Herzegovina. We're going to see it in the Tutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda and other places. And in fact, if there's anything that we need to start learning about this, is we really need a sense of peace and pacification rather than war, but we're warring societies, in my view.
I mean, even if you look at Afghanistan, there is a country that has been at war for over 20 years, and much of that period it has been a war with itself, not even when the Soviets weren't there. These people, for more than a generation almost, don't know what peace is. The kids have no conception of it.
That's right.
One of the things we were talking about, South African justice, for example, I don't know how to pronounce it, lawyer jurga, whatever the lay the elders get together and resolve conflict. That, to me, is going to be an area which we really need to take some time and study for a sense of peace studies for two or three reasons. One, if you notice how, first of all, the U.S. would not put its troops on the ground. They used the Northern Alliance to fight the war for them. And then when it was all over, these guys shaking hands and kissing each other and negotiating releases and whatnot. Of course, we were probably fuming inside that we're letting people go the way that they're being let go. But not only has there been that warring aspect of Afghanistan, there has been this tribal aspect that has some positiveness about it. I don't know if positive is the right word, but has a sameness about it, where you get together and you negotiate over the fate of people, and you don't necessarily go out and kill. How that's going to play itself out after this current war, I don't know. And whether the U.S. is going to covertly stay there to do its own thing, I don't know. Because after all, oil is a driving force for much of our interest there.
That's true, but I mean, oil drives a lot of this, and I agree with you fully that these are, battles over land and water and that sort of stuff. But ultimately, the people getting ingrained,
right,
with a genetic momentum,
right,
that keeps it going, and it's hard to break the cycle. I've often thought that part of what you have to do is remove people from the environment, even if that means just going to a fair or something that is a different environment for them to see what's possible. I remember seeing somewhere about a group of kids that came over from the Middle East, Palestinians and Israelis, to a camp, teenagers, and for a summer, and they found out a lot about each other, that they were more alike than they realized, and became friends. But they all said that when, you know, when they went back to their country, it wasn't something that they could continue. It wasn't something that the environment would support. And it's really hard for them to be able to maintain those friendships when they got back.
There is another model of that in Israel, where a group of Palestinians and Israeli Jewish are living together in this community. It's a selected community outside of Haifa, I think it is, or Tel Aviv, I'm not sure which one of the places. And what's sad is that they grow up together, and then when it gets to high school, they force them to live apart. And it's also sad that the government has not supported the community. This is not a kibbutz. I wish I could remember. It has some term peace in it, in both Palestinian and I don't remember the name, but if you most obviously know about the community. We really do need more models of that, not only in Israel, but in Ireland and Northern Ireland and many places in the world. Remember, this thing started out about the biogenesis and development of terrorism. What we really are also trying to say is that the way to ameliorate terrorism is by some of these actions that you're just now talking about. Because if the longer we allow these people to go at it, the more terrorism, I think, is going to proceed.
I'd like to come back to what you were talking about before. This is being rooted in passive aggressive behavior. And how do you treat, if that's the right word, passive aggressive behavior in normal circumstances, and how would you apply those treatments to this situation when you've got it involved with, a war situation?
Well, the normal psychiatric model is you deal with passive aggression by responding with active aggression. You try to say, look at what you're doing. You're procrastinating, you're delaying, you're stabbing in the back, you're doing all these different things. Let's bring it out into the open and confront it. The question that this current situation raises that is now very intriguing to me is one could argue that the war on terrorism, as Bush calls it, is converting it into active aggression. But then he adds this other caveat, you're either with us or you're against us. That we are the people who are ultimately right and everyone else is wrong. So it's going to breed a new form of sort of aggression. New models of, let's suppose the alliance has worked up to a point and has gotten us where we are now, and then they start attacking another country, Sudan or Iraq or whatever, Syria. It's only going to lead to just a greater sense of rage and clever response, which we can't even foresee. I mean, just the guy that had the shooter recently who had the explosives in it just shows us how far people can go. He was pretty stupid about how he did it, but just think if that had gone off, we'd never been able to figure out who it was and what the backstory.
If we step back and get a larger perspective, has this not been going on in various forms for thousands of years? I mean, if we point to human history, if we point to what human beings have done to one another, I mean, slavery in this country, I mean, they had an incredible exhibit of the torture devices of the Spanish Inquisition from the Presidio not long ago. The wars, look at the last century, how many people were killed. But this is, at this point, for the last at least 3,500 years that we know about, this is what human beings have been doing. And if there's any credence to what you're proposing, are we not a contaminated species at this point? We are.
There are also species that can evolve, and I think we're
yes.
And what you're leaning towards is a kind of a genetic morphology, which I'm actually very much in favor of. In other words, if we are being tested and extruded from this mandible of evolution, where our own stupidity and clumsiness kind of eventually gets to the point where you can begin to understand how this process works, then we can also sort of use these tools that we're being given. Like I said, you're about to take advantage of the use of Smith technology, which is very recent, and is really being driven by the gene pharmaceutical industry. But what a wonderful way to reapply it, so that we can, in fact, unravel the genetic markers that are probably embedded for all these thousands of years. So now we have a window of time, maybe a handful of years, to sort of get in there and accelerate the morphology in a morphology way.
We also have the potential for developing yet another technology that we can abuse.
Exactly. Yes. And the hope that you reduce this to inoculate against violence or against this kind of negative.
I've actually thought about that. I do want to come to one point, though, that you made that I had intended to mention that I forgot to mention. Blacks in America have been terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan for hundreds of years. We see very little discussion of that in this current situation. And I'm sure that women feel that they've been terrorized. In fact, as I was driving up here this week, two women, Rita Nakashima Brock and some other woman, Rebecca something, have a new book called Proverbs of Something. And they talk about violence in the Bible and how that violence is aimed against women and children. They point out that one way to view Christ on the cross is he's sacrificing for mankind, but another way is that this is violence and in the most extreme form. And so what they essentially propose is a feminist analysis of the Bible, not to undo what they call the sons of the kids of Abraham. In fact, one of the points they make is that all of the Christianity, Islam, Judaism, the way these religions sort of split off is precisely because of violence. You know, the issue of Isaac and Abraham and splitting a child, and there's just a history of this behavior. In fact, the question about Buddhism is kind of interesting because it has not been born out of this degree of violence. And I think that's one bit of the dialogue that's coming out of this World Trade Center. I think more Americans are beginning to think about at least the three major religions. They're not looking at Buddhism necessarily, but it may be time that they, after seeing this tension between the religions and what they mean, that they will now move further and look at religion and spirituality, religiosity.
Buddhism is probably the only religion that has not propagated war.
I hadn't thought about that, but I think you're right.
I think so.
Although people right now would argue that the situation between the Hindus and the Pakistanis is
just...
Although
the
fortunate Japan was
Buddhist
at the time of World War II.
I think the trouble is Sri Lanka has one side as
Buddhist. It is a condition of our species.
Yeah,
you're saying this is a condition of our species. Let's look at it. Let's look at it thoughtfully.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go down to the molecular level.
Yes.
And let's see thoughtfully what we can do about it.
Yes.
Right.
And then you've got a Kohlberg's moral kind
right.
of development. Family building experiment,
right.
Mentioned, and actually use our thoughtful development, our evil,
mm-hmm.
Evolving to this point, to say, okay, what are we going to do about this as a species? Because we are really
mm-hmm.
global.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like to think about. We like to think about different nations.
Mm-hmm.
We are no longer nations.
Mm-hmm. If we get to the point of thinking in science fiction terms, you know, invaders from space and whatnot, we really are going to have to deal with these issues. And so the sooner and the faster we can get to the core, it will be better. I didn't put a structure, a brain, a moral development, because I didn't know one. I don't know one. But I have no doubt in my mind that there will be some structural concomitances, I guess is what I'd call it. And the examples from this Shikoto Dotoku, the Japanese elementary morality education, shows that at least the Japanese, whether we, you know, you can say what you like about them in terms of their treatment of Koreans and the competition they get in, all kinds of things, but at least they thought through enough to develop a sense of morality education. And, you know, you could argue that this is Shinto or this is Buddhist or whatever, Taoist or whatever the underpinnings are. In fact, I have little doubt that the MacArthur compromise or the constitution in Japan played a role in the way this textbook is implemented. It does raise the issue of whether our society may need, once we have been able to do the study and find out how different moral leanings, underpinnings plays out in some way, it does raise the fundamental issue of should we have a what I call a caveats emptor in terms of moral development, and what should that be? Should the Tesla Society play a major role in shaping? Well, you're the one place where you can come to San Francisco and talk about things penetrating in. That's why I always like coming here, because, you know, a meeting is supposed to stop at 3 o'clock and it can go on to 5 and go to dinner, and we can just, you have a great opportunity to really get into issues in ways that we would never be able to do otherwise. We just don't have in our society the social intellectual structure for dealing with this level of thinking, and it's to me it's very, very exciting. We need that. We need a equivalent of the philosopher kings, if we can think of it that way. And then the question is how do we get people to come into the discussion who may have an important role? The homeless, for example, or the Asians, or the people in the artists.
I got to stop you.